Since the very beginning, Christ believed it, the apostles believed it, the early church fathers believed it, the medieval church fathers believed it, the Reformation church fathers believed it, on into the modern world. Now, what happened in the contemporary world that caused the denial of this belief, which was committed once for all to the saints? I'd like to point out, first of all, that it was not any factual studies, any archaeological findings that led people to the denial of inerrancy. It was a philosophical change in the climate, not a factual or evidential change. And so it's incumbent upon us to look at this philosophical climate and change, to trace it back to its roots, and to find out how to treat the disease. I'm always amused by Christians who say, "Why do you spend all your time studying these false philosophies? Didn't the Bible say, beware of philosophy? Only time the word is used." And my response to that is true. We are to beware of philosophy, but the only way to beware of it is to be aware of it. And the person most likely to fall prey to a false philosophy is not the person who doesn't study it, but the person who does. Rather, not the person who does study it, but the person who doesn't. For instance, if you went to a doctor and you gave him all your symptoms and you said, "I got a pain in my apostat near my Zorch and, my sacroiliac's not too good," and the doctor says, "I don't study disease. I just study health." What would you do? You'd find yourself another doctor. Now, if you come to somebody who says, "I don't study air. I just study truth," what do you do? If you're going to treat the disease, you better study it. And if we're going to treat the disease at the root of the denial of inerrancy, we have to study it. Now, the root of the denial of many biblical doctrines is really the anti-supernaturalism or the naturalism of David Hume. Much of the higher critical rejection of Scripture is based on the fact that they cannot and will not believe in the supernatural. For instance, there are no factual studies that led people to deny that Isaiah was an 8th century prophet. But when you look at Isaiah 45 and he says Cyrus is going to be used in the hands of God to accomplish his purposes, and it's 200 years before Cyrus was on the scene, then you say, Isaiah could not have been an 8th century prophet. He must have lived a little later, a couple hundred years later, after Cyrus, and had written this after he knew his name, because, of course, he could not have known his name 200 years in advance. True, if there is no God and no supernatural things occur, it would be impossible for him to do that. So the real basis for the rejection of the unity of Isaiah, and that Isaiah wrote the whole book, is built on an anti-supernatural premise. Likewise, Daniel. Daniel was a 6th century prophet. But when you read Daniel chapter 11, you see a detailed description of what Antiochus Epiphanes did to the Jews. You say, wait a minute, nobody could know this in advance. Daniel must have lived 165 B.C. after it all happened, and not back in the 500s. The problem isn't that they found textual or historical evidence to support this. It's that philosophically they no longer believe in the supernatural, and therefore superimposed upon the Bible their anti-supernatural bias and came to these conclusions. Jonah, for example. It's not a question of historical evidence that proved that Jonah was never there, but he was never swallowed by the great fish. What is the problem? Is it's miraculous, and how can you believe in the miraculous, and anybody records something like that obviously has to be a myth. That's a whale of a tale, not a tale of a whale. Why? Because it's so supernatural. They just can't swallow the story, so to speak. Now, that reminds me of the little girl on the sidewalk from the Salvation Army with her Bible, and the town skeptic came by and he said, "You don't believe that, do you? Believe all those miracles and those things, fantastic things like axe heads swimming in water and people being swallowed by great..." She said, "If you mean, do I believe the Bible? Yes, I believe everything from Genesis to Revelation. And you believe that Jonah was swallowed by a great whale?" She said, "I believe it." And the skeptic said, "Well, how do you know it's true?" She thought a moment. She said, "Well, when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask Jonah." The skeptic said to her, "Well, what if Jonah's not in heaven?" She said, "Then you ask him." The problem... Now, what I'd like to suggest is that any adequate defense of the inerrancy of the Bible is going to have to be a defense of miracles. And so we'd like to go to the root of this particular problem, which is David Hume. David Hume died in 1776. That shouldn't be hard to remember. And his influence has spread right to modern times, and what we're really going to do is go through Hume's anti-supernatural arguments and trace them up to the present and try and give an answer for the reason of the hope that is in us with meekness and fear, 1 Peter 3:15. Here's how Hume's first argument went. A miracle, by definition, is a violation of a law of nature. But the laws of nature are built on the highest degree of probability. We call it a law because it happens over and over and over again. It'll probably happen again. You stick somebody's head under the water for 5 minutes and he drowns. You do it to the next guy and he drowns. And after 100 people, you come to the conclusion there must be some law of nature here because they all keep drowning. Thirdly, a miracle by definition is based on the lowest degree of probability because it happens only rarely. Doesn't happen over and over and over again. If it did, it wouldn't be a miracle. Now, the wise man always bases his belief on the highest probability. Therefore, the wise man should never believe in miracles. Now, notice, number one, Hume didn't say miracles didn't occur. He just said a wise man shouldn't believe in them. A wise man bases his belief on the highest probability. Like the laws of nature, miracles are built on the lowest degree of probability. Therefore, a wise man who always bases his belief on the highest degree of probability should never believe a miracle. Let me give a counter illustration as to why this is not so. In fact, two of them. Suppose we have four honest, sober, sane people playing bridge, or if you're Christian, rook. Now, and suppose that they deal a perfect bridge hand. What are the chances that you can get a perfect bridge hand? The chances are 1 in 635,013,559,600. That's the chances for a perfect bridge hand. That's just one, not all four. That's I don't even have the figure for all four. It's big. Now, the point is this. Highly improbable to get a perfect bridge hand, but it does happen. Every once in a while you see it reported in the paper. Just because it's highly improbable doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And when it happened, would you rather believe four honest, sane, sober, intelligent people or the mathematical probabilities against it happening? It's highly improbable mathematically, but factually it did occur. Same thing is true of a miracle. Simply because it's highly improbable doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. For instance, suppose on a smoggy day, which I assume is quite often in Los Angeles, we fly over and before that we go down in front of what, the Church of the Open Door, and we put a little circle the size of a half a dollar on the sidewalk. And we take our half dollar up in the airplane and we throw it at random out over Los Angeles. What are the chances it's going to fall in that circle the size of a half dollar in front of the Church of the Open Door? Chances aren't good. I don't even know how to figure them out, but it's a big number. Now let's change the illustration. Say it's highly improbable that that would fall in that circle, but if I go up over Los Angeles, throw it a half a dollar, and it falls somewhere, anywhere, then I go up to the half dollar and I draw a circle around it, and I pick the half dollar up and I say, what are the chances that that half dollar would fall in that circle? Exactly the same chances as the first case. Exactly the same. But it did happen. Just because it's highly improbable doesn't mean it never happens. Miracles are surely highly improbable. God can overcome any improbability. The only thing he can't overcome is an impossibility. He can't make square circles. He can't make a stick with one end or two mountains without a valley. God can't do the impossible. The law of contradiction, that apparently tickled somebody there, that stick with one end. God can do the improbable, but not the impossible. Well, there's a second kind of revision to Hume's problem, and this particular revision comes from a contemporary philosopher named Anthony Flew. In his article on miracles in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy, Anthony Flew argues this way. Miracles are by nature particular and unrepeatable. If they were general and repeatable, they wouldn't be miracles. Secondly, scientific laws by nature describe general and repeatable events. If it can be done over and over, it becomes a general law. We call that a scientific law. Thirdly, but evidence for the repeatable and general is always greater for than for the particular and unrepeatable. Evidence for what can be repeated over and over is greater than evidence for that which can't be repeated over and over. Scientific or critical man will never base his belief on the lesser evidence. The scientific mind will always base its belief on the general and repeatable evidence. Therefore, the critical man will never believe in a miracle. Now, that's just a revision of Hume's premise. Science is based on the repeatable and general. Miracles are particular and unrepeatable. The evidence for the general is always greater and the repeatable than the evidence for the particular and the unrepeatable. Therefore, the wise man won't believe it. Notice again, he does not deny the possibility of miracles, only the believability of miracles. It's a far more subtle undermining. Now, let me point out the problem of Flew's position. This same Anthony Flew is the person who devised a principle called, or articulated it really, falsifiability. And here's what he said. He said, the trouble with you Christians is there's no condition under which you would allow your belief to be falsified. For example, you believe God is loving if he does good things to you, and you believe he's loving if he does bad things to you. If your closest friend dies of cancer, you still believe he's loved. There's nothing that can falsify your belief. It's an unfalsifiable belief. But, said Flew, if it's unfalsifiable, it's unverifiable. Because if you won't let anything count against it, you shouldn't let anything count for it. That's been called the principle of falsifiability. That was Anthony Flew who articulated it. And that same Anthony Flew has an unfalsifiable view of miracles. Because no matter what happens, he will not let it count as evidence for a miracle. It doesn't matter what in the world occurred. Always by their very nature, if it's particular and unrepeatable, don't believe it. So no matter what miracle occurred, it would be literally unbelievable. Flew entertained this particular objection that I'm giving, and he said, well, it is falsifiable in principle, but not in practice. And all we have to do is say, well, so is my faith falsifiable in principle, but not in practice. If you can accept it against miracles, I can accept it for God, and we've got a standoff. The truth of the matter is, Flew was not willing to allow anything, and here is the basic begging the question, which we call petitio principi in philosophy. He begs the question this way. Whatever happens in the natural world is a natural event. Once an alleged miracle occurs in the natural world, it's a natural event. Hence, an alleged miracle is ipso facto a natural event. Now, if you believe that, of course, miracles can never happen. Let me give you one illustration. I know, and I personally verified this. This is not a hoax, and I've talked over 3 hours with the person and verified the records. There's a boy by the name of David Pelletier who sees without an eye. Now, he has no left eye. He has a glass eye there, and when he's about 9 years of age, his left eye was hurt, and his father prayed that it would be healed. Well, it wasn't healed. They had to take it out. But his father kept praying, and his mother said to him, now, look, if you're going to pray for him to see with his left eye and he's got a glass eye, just don't tell anybody about it because they'll think you're nuts. So he and a close group of friends continued to pray for 2.5 years. He was a Bible church pastor in the Midwest. 2.5 years later, little David Pelletier came bouncing out of the bedroom one night and said, Dad, I can see with my bad eye, which is what he called his glass eye. And they covered his right eye and he could see. He had depth perception. They took him to doctors, Christian and non-Christian. They verified it's on record. all over the United States and world. I've seen him. He takes his eye out. They cover up his right eye. He takes things at random from the audience. He read. He was at Trinity Chapel. He read University of Delaware off a kid's ring. He reached in the Bible. He has X-ray vision, actually, with his left eye. Now you say, normally we say that's a miracle. You know, God has a theological and spiritual context. They prayed. They gave the glory to God. It's a highly unusual event. It has all the characteristics of a miracle. I read an article by a naturalist explaining this. Now, he didn't deny it because you can't deny it. It's a fact. The boy sees without his left eye and he has depth perception. That's a fact. So you can't deny the fact. What did the naturalist do? The naturalist said, now we know you don't need eyes to see. Someday, we'll be able to see through the ends of our elbow and out our fingertips. Well, he has an unfalsifiable, incurable, naturalistic bias. Whatever happens in the world is ipso facto natural. Before it happened, it might possibly be a miracle, but once it happens, it couldn't be. Now suppose somebody comes up to the resurrected Christ, sticks his finger in his hand in his side, and says, aha, now we know that resurrections are natural events, because it has happened. Incurable naturalistic bias. That's precisely what is going on behind Flew's argument. Now, the naturalists don't take all of this lying down. They get very sophisticated, and there's a third and even more subtle revision of the anti-miracle argument, and it goes something like this. Scientific laws are merely descriptions of events and not prescriptions. See, in David Hume's day, they thought of a law as a prescriptive thing. It's pretty hard to violate a prescriptive law. But now modern science thinks of the universe as open, and there aren't prescriptive, immovable, unchangeable, eternal natural laws. They're just scientific descriptions of them. So a scientific law is merely a description of an event, not a prescription. Secondly, descriptions cannot be violated. They can merely be revised. You don't violate a description. You revise it. For instance, if I tell you Moody Bible Institute in Chicago is south of Madison Street, and you have a mental map of Madison Street dividing Chicago in half, east and west, and Moody Bible Institute being south, and you take a trip to Chicago, and you find out that Moody Bible Institute is about 8 blocks north of Madison Street, does that violate your mental map? No, it just causes you to revise it. Now you change the mental map, and you don't have a violation of your previous law description, you just have a revision. So scientific laws are descriptions. Descriptions can't be violated. They're merely revised. However, a miracle by nature must be a violation. Therefore, miracles by nature can't occur. Because once it occurs, it becomes a natural event. Now notice again the incurable naturalistic bias in this particular argument. It is petitio principii. It begs the question by assuming whatever happens in nature is naturally caused. Once the thing occurs, it becomes part of your natural description of the universe, whether it's David Pelletier's eye or Christ's resurrection. Unjustifiable presupposition that what occurs in nature is caused by nature. At this point, C.S. Lewis has a very penetrating argument in his book, God in the Dock, in his chapter on miracles. And he says, you know, it occurred to me one day that nothing is ever caused by a natural law. If a natural law is simply a description, it's not a cause. For instance, if I have 7 pennies plus 5 pennies in my pocket, then the laws of mathematics say there must be 12. But that's just a description. That law, 7 plus 5 equals 12, didn't put the pennies in my pocket. The law simply describes what is the case. So natural laws don't cause anything. They just describe things. Nothing was ever caused by nature. That's just a description of some causal power that is there. Furthermore, let me give a counter illustration to this description. Is it true that every time we find an exception, that we revise the map? Is it true that a scientist, every time he sees an exception, revises the map? Not so. What if we were out by a pond, a lovely little pond, and we were sitting there in the afternoon, and out of the pond emerged a muskrat. And it came up in midair, and it floated in midair for about 2 minutes, and you hit the person next to him and say, "What do you see?" "Looks to me like a muskrat. What's it doing? It's floating in midair." And the person next to you, and several of you witnessed this, and then the muskrat drops right back down into the pond. Let us suppose you're all scientists. Will those scientists go back to the textbook and revise the laws of gravitation and the laws about muskrats? No. They'll say, "Anomaly. That is anomalous. Doesn't come under any law. We don't know how to explain it. It's an anomaly." So not every exception calls for revision. When and only when do you revise a scientific law? When you can repeat it over and over and over again. Then it becomes a part of the natural description. Resurrections you can't repeat over and over and over again. Virgin births you can't repeat over and over. Therefore, there are some legitimate exceptions that do not call for revision. You can be a scientist and also believe in miracles. Now, there's a further objection, and this one comes from Guy Robinson. And this is built on the nature of the scientific method, and it's exceedingly subtle. It goes this way. Science as science, science qua science, must assume that all events are naturally explainable. But if all events are scientifically explainable, no event is supernatural. Therefore, science as science eliminates the supernatural. Now, let us suppose that as a scientist, you came across an exception to a known description of nature. What would you do as a scientist? You just say, it's an exception. I'll just leave it there as an exception, and I won't do anything else with it. No, you don't cry miracle when you find an exception. Suppose you find an exception to Newton's law of gravity, and you find that it doesn't really work in interspatial travel, as Newton described it. It doesn't really work when you go closer to the depth of the center of the Earth. And you find an exception to the law the way Newton put it. What do you do? Miracle. Outer space apparently is miraculous, or closer to the center is miraculous. Not as a scientist. As a scientist, you assume there's another natural explanation and a broader one, and you revise the theory of gravitation and devise the theory of relativity. So that every exception, rather than calling a scientist to his knees and crying miracle, goads him on to revise and get a bigger and better law to explain it. So scientists as scientists can never admit the possibility of a miracle because it would be giving up the scientific method. That leads, by way of response to that, to a distinction. Is it true that because a scientist can explain how something happened, that he has explained why it happened? Is it true that because 7 plus 5 equals 12 explains why the 10 pennies were placed in my pocket? Not so. So even if a scientist could explain how a miracle occurred, he would not thereby, ipso facto, explain why and when. Let's take some Old Testament examples. Suppose you could explain how God pushed back the Red Sea, and not with a lot of forced air through jello, like Cecil B. did it. Suppose you could explain how this thing happened. Would that take away the miraculous? No, because the Bible does tell us how God did it. Caused a strong east wind to blow all night, and it blew the waters back. Does that take away from the miraculous simply because you know how? No, because you still don't know why it happened, when it happened, apart from invoking God's activity. Likewise, a scientist could come to explain the modus operandi, I do not believe that he will, of all miracles. He could explain how they all come to be and still not explain away the miraculous element, because why it happened, when it happened, could still be the intervention of God in this particular scene. Furthermore, this argument simply assumes that the scientific method, as a scientific method, must be naturalistic. And I would like to say, in counter to that, that the scientist only has to be scientific. He does not have to be metaphysical. He could assume as a working procedure that he will always keep pressing for more explanations without committing himself to the metaphysical position that there are no supernatural explanations. So what he adopts as a pragmatic procedure for the purpose of research need not be a metaphysical assumption for the purpose of denying God. Well, the naturalists haven't given up. They still have another objection, and this comes from Alistair MacKinnon, M-C-K-I-N-N-O-N. And this one shows how ridiculously circular the arguments get. It goes as follows. A natural happening is what occurs in the actual course of events. Okay. A miracle, by definition, would be contrary to the actual course of events. But nothing can be contrary to the actual course of events. What is, is. Therefore, miracles cannot occur. Profound, PhD in philosophy, but circular. Now, if you assume that whatever occurs in the world is ipso facto not miraculous, then of course the argument follows. But that begs the question, isn't it possible that there are some things that are caused in nature but not by nature? Isn't it possible that there are things caused from beyond nature but operate in the natural realm? As a matter of fact, most miracles in the Bible, if not all of them, have a very natural dimension to them. For instance, when God causes a virgin birth, it results in a 9-month pregnancy. Very natural process. Jesus turned water to wine. Not an unnatural process. Happens all the time. The rain comes down, goes through the roots, up in the vine and the grapes, and the grapes turn to wine. Jesus speeded it up a little bit. Granted, might be an additional element there, but it is not contrary to nature. Miracles have a very natural result and often a natural process. Many of the biblical miracles are simply speeding up of natural process with an added outside ingredient. Multiplying loaves happens all the time. Every time you plant wheat, it multiplies. It takes a whole season to do it. Jesus did it a little more quickly when he multiplied the loaves. Cursing the fig tree, the one negative miracle in the Bible, normally was going to wither up anyway. He just speeded up the process, withered a little faster. So miracles are not against nature or contrary to nature. They often complement nature and make nature work more naturally. So to say that whatever occurs in the course of actual events could not be a miracle is to misunderstand the nature of miracles. This leads me to another objection of David Hume. And it goes like this. Hume says, no truth claims can be supported by miracles if any contrary truth claim is also supported by a miracle, because contrary truth claims would be mutually self-canceling. If a Mormon comes along and says, I believe that the Book of Mormon is inspired of God because I have miracles to support it, and someone else comes along, let's say a Muslim, and I believe the Quran is the word of God and I have a miracle to support it, that would be self-canceling because the two books are mutually exclusive and they both have the same kind of miracles to support their claims. But, says Hume, all religious systems claim miracles in support of their truth. Therefore, no miracle can be used to support a religious truth claim.